I'm Gabriella. I'm guessing you know that.
No.
Two Girls Roman. The travel vlog. That's me and Jamila.
Podcast. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
But we're guessing you already know who we are.
No.
Nope.
What?
No.
Nope.
No!
Nope.
No. We didn't know you.
I haven't seen it.
Really? Three guys moaning? The Doctor Who vlog? That's us. Oh, where have you been? Anyway, what are all these podcasters doing in our... Get out. Go on. Shoo. Shoo. Boys, I've told you. No gentleman guests after hours. All right? Anyway, happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 126 of the Diddly Dumb Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. Once again, I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I am still Mark.
Oh, and welcome back, Hayden.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it's nice to be allowed back in. I thought, after Brenny's incredible performance, I thought maybe you'd have changed the locks.
Well, we were on the point of doing so when you heard the dreadful news that Brendan had got knocked down by an Australian pantechnicon during his walk to work with Whittaker. I watched a few of those on YouTube, and I was flinching every 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Mainly thinking... What muscles does he have to hold his, what I presume is his phone up in front of his face at that height? Unflinching.
Well, have you heard of selfie sticks, Doc? Because that's, I suspect that's how he's getting away with it.
Oh, right. But that would still...
But that would only add to the mass which he's carrying.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. He's a strong dude.
What's been happening since we last spoke to you? They've lost Nicholas Parsons.
Yeah.
Of course, in the last week, which was, I don't think it was quite a shock until you quite realised how old he was. I didn't realise he was quite as far along as he was.
No, because he was recording just a minute, pretty much right up until very near the end, wasn't he, really? Mm. So, and he still sounded, whenever you heard him on the radio, he still sounded absolutely 100% as sharp as he ever had done.
Played the vicar in... Curse of Fenric, of course.
Yeah.
Surprising everyone, I imagine, who'd generally only thought of him as either a straight man, a panel show chairman, or a quiz show chairman. And of course, certainly in my youth, in what I regard as being the golden age of Just a Minute, my equivalent of my doctor, my panellists, very late 70s, early 80s, were the regular quartet of... Derek Nimmo, Clement Freud, Peter Jones from Hitchhiker's Guide.
Oh, you've got another new presenter in, have you, while I've been away?
Yeah. And, of course, primus inter pares, the great Kenneth Williams.
Oh, yeah.
Every week I used to listen to it. Splendid times, splendid times. I've been rummaging around in my gander bag, and I found... a couple of old recordings, which we shall play just before the end credits at the end of the podcast, in salute to Nicholas's great days, sharing Just a Minute.
I quite agree with your challenge of repetition of experience, Kenneth.
Deviation.
Because he wasn't deviating.
Deviation,
you stick to repetition, and you have the subject of, with 4.5 seconds to go, starting now.
My worst public appearance was at Boscombe when my costume came off.
Kenneth, you have a point for speaking as the whistle went. Would you like to continue your worst public experience?
No, it's just that the costume came off, but it was a child's play. It wasn't a professional performance, so therefore I don't count it professionally as a black mark against myself.
No, it wasn't very funny, was it?
It wasn't very funny, but then neither are you. You're still chairman week in, week out.
Fortunately, I'm not paid to be.
Aren't you? Oh, no. You could have fooled me.
You're not paid to be chairman?
Oh, no.
Yeah, I've heard he is paid to be chairman.
I'm not paid to be a funny chairman.
I've heard he
does
very well out of it,
too. Yeah. Pointing it in, I'm too. Having a new bathroom put in. ceramic. All done avocados. Avocado, ceramic. Can you believe? That white lavatory's been good enough for me for years.
Yes.
Affectation of these people. They get up in the world and they start, you know, and I ask myself, how does he do what he does and what he gets? That's what I ask myself. Do I get any answer? No, I don't. You notice he's mute. He's gone quiet. Look. I'm quiet. Yeah, wipe the sheet. Look, he's gone white. Look. Yeah, it's a guilt.
No. When I hear a comic genius at play, I let him go.
Oh.
I let the audience enjoy it and have the full value of your wit, your humour, your erudition, your talent and your charm.
And about your tongue, I get blood poisoning.
Kenneth, at the end of that round, after your rudeness, which the audience enjoyed, we all enjoyed, actually, that's why we asked you back. If you couldn't be rude to Nicholas Parsons, I don't know who else can. Kenneth, you are in second place.
The subject is stopping hiccups. Can you tell us something about that in this game, starting now?
One of the best tips I can give you is to inhale deeply and then recite a long piece. Such as the old order changes the irreplaceable new and God fools himself in many ways as one good craftsman should corrupt the world. Comfort thyself, what comfort is in me? I have lived my life, and that which I have done may he with himself may feel, but thou.
Peter Jones has challenged.
You'd be better off with the hiccups.
So, anything else been happening Doctor Who wise or interesting life wise?
I had a book come out on the 3rd of February, Tales from Another Me, which is a collection of poems and lyrics from my time as a teenager. They're actually written, I think the youngest I was, I think it's chronicling my life from the age of 16 to about 20, I think, through what I was writing at the time. And I've decided to release it as a paperback when it was previously available as an ebook. I've released it as a paperback this time round because I'd like the proceeds from it to go to the charity Mind UK.
M-I-N-D, right. Okay, well, we shall plug that outrageously in forthcoming weeks and in all the show notes.
You'd be the only one who is.
We came to a rather shocking discovery when we were posting Podcast 125 online, Faithless Sisters, which is, it wouldn't go. And then we realised that the blog that hosts our podcast and has done for the last 6 years, we'd finally exhausted the amount of storage we're allowed. So we're going to have to start deciding whether to pay a little bit more to upgrade to it or go to another site entirely to host it. But whatever happens shouldn't make any difference to you. I imagine that your various platforms, iTunes, Audioboo, etc., will just redirect a new feed to whatever devices you use. So what we've done in the meantime, and this was a wrench, is that I have deleted the recordings of podcasts 001 through to 005, which freed up for us about 3/4 of a gigabyte.
Missing episodes?
Yes! Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
Wiped them.
I've become more interesting now. I'm going to have to have a podcast about that.
It was that Roger K. Barrett that did it. If I could get my hands on that Roger K. Barrett.
Oh, Roger K. Barrett.
If any of you ever want to get hold of one of them, with, of course, they're still on our own hard drives, just drop us a line at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk and we'll either put one that you want back up briefly or we'll find some way of getting to you by Dropbox or whatever. It's only a temporary measure.
C90 tape in the post?
Yes, something like that.
Wax
cylinder. Or perhaps a wax cylinder. I was trying to say wax cylinder.
Oh, the season 12 box set is being reissued.
Oh, yes, I'm pleased you mentioned that, mate.
If you saw fireworks being let off in Faversham.
Yeah. I tried to pre-order it on Zoom, but because I didn't have the money in my account, they wouldn't let me do it. So I had to go and pre-order it from Amazon. They don't care if I've got the money now or not, so that's good.
Oh, so I see. So, to... I know Amazon don't take it until
they actually dispatch it, do they? No, so I'm going to have to try to keep an eye on my bank account for once and be a grown-up.
But you have pre-ordered it, yeah?
I have actually pre-ordered it, yes. I had a bit of a panic because I saw somebody online saying, oh, I've heard that they've already sold out again. Don't know where these people hear these things, but I went straight to Amazon and tried to pre-order it. And, it still seems strange, doesn't it,
that they seem to have... it's coming out in March, isn't it?
March the 9th, just over a month ago.
You just thought they might give it a bit longer, see how many people are pre-ordering it, so they can say, well, we might print a few more copies of it.
Well, yeah. I'm wondering if people are pre-ordering large amounts of it, because it was selling for, I think, I saw on Twitter Neil Perriman saying that he'd, of the Wife in Space blog, was saying that he'd, I think he'd been financially short at one point, and so he sold his lone copy of it, is the only one he had. He sold that on eBay, and he got about £300 for it.
Bloody hell. And now he's moving house, just in case the person he sold it to comes after him.
I mean, when I did keep going on eBay and looking at it, and yeah, it was going for ridiculous prices, and he goes through the ones that have sold, and they have gone for hundreds of pounds. And he just kept thinking, but that's ridiculous. Surely you just wait, and they're going to re-release it at some point.
Hayden and I actually had to physically prevent Mark from going and selling his body on the streets, listeners.
Didn't take much prevention.
If you've ever walked down Faversham High Street and seen a desperate young man, young, with a beard holding up a placard saying, get it here.
I was down the docks.
Do you think that this may set a precedent for the others, though? Because they all do seem to sell out rather quickly. And then after about a month or two, they're all gone.
Yeah, I think Series 10's sold out, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Which is the most recent one that's sold out, I think.
No, a Trial of a Time Lord's been sold out now.
Trial of a Time Lord sold out?
Yeah, I'm sure it has.
I mean, Trial of a Time Lord sold out.
I think 23's gone. I'm just double-checking on the computer. Yeah, Season 10, so that's John Pertwee's Blu-ray has been sold out, and so has Colin Baker's one, season 23. Sorry, I don't know whether I can completely zone out or not, but I asked the question whether you thought they'd set a precedent with this, and I can't remember.
Oh, sorry, yes, you did, didn't you? I mean, clearly they're not prepared to have, you know, much stuck in a warehouse somewhere in the off chance that it might take someone.
Yeah, I think it's good to do it this way. To pre-order, yeah. And then maybe book another, I don't know, 1,000 or something over over the pre-order number. Because it is also a lack of waste then, isn't it? Because you think of how many videos, DVDs and what have you have been printed in the past. And I don't think any of them have ever, you know, gone off the market, apart from possibly the Key to Time box set. I think apart from that, I think all of them have all stayed in circulation until recently, actually. I don't think they're on Amazon that much anymore now.
What, the DVDs, as opposed to
of the classic series, certainly. And the Eccleston and Tennant series have been re-released a few times already in the last 15 years. So, you know, they're... I think it's a sensible way to go ahead with these things. But then again, of course, it very much depends on whether people have the money to buy them at the same time.
Yeah.
The thing is, there's not much you can do with the old discs, the old videotapes, is there, if you can't sell them? So they just end up going round and round in plastic gyres in the middle of the ocean.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it now. I'm just on Amazon now, and actually an awful lot of the classic era DVDs have gone. And as you say, currently unavailable, or they're available as Region 1 DVDs, by the looks of it. Yeah, Region 2 is completely unavailable now. Mm-hmm. For a lot of the classic... Yeah, all the classic ones are gone.
Well, yeah, plus there's not much point reissuing them, is there? Because the people are just going to, if they want them, they'll be picking them up secondhand, won't they, the DVDs?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as you know, Faithful Sisters, I've been racked with indecision in that as I get these new Blu-ray box sets and they replace my original DVDs, unfortunately, we're making the Diddly Dum podcast. My desktop doesn't accept, doesn't read Blu-rays, so I can't take audio snips off.
You said this, yeah.
So instead of ending up as I thought I might do once they brought out Blu-rays, having a rather small shelf of Doctor Who stuff, I've ended up with about twice I thought I'd have. I think I might just have to get myself a Blu-ray reader or carry on messing around with Daily Motion.
Well, I mean, you could just keep the discs in a wallet, if you know what I mean.
DVD wallet.
Get rid of the cases.
Do you know what? I used to absolutely adore, and I still do actually, I used to absolutely adore going around people's houses and seeing just, and then the sentence ends.
Stealing their target books.
No, I used to love seeing their, you know, what videos or DVDs or Blu-rays they had on the shelves and what books they had on there, because I felt like it was an in to their kind of their personality. Yeah. And you could say, oh, I like that, or I like that. It's very rare now when I go over friends' houses that they even have anything up, really.
That's because your reputation precedes you.
Well, yeah, there you are.
They've locked it all away in the cupboard.
It says about Queen Mary, didn't they? When Queen Mary used to go visiting grand houses around the country, people would lock away their most valuable antiques, because she'd always go to them and say, oh, I like that one, and they feel obliged to give it to her as a gift.
That is true. That has been my tactic in the past and will continue to be. But there you go.
I've usually just given mine to charity shops, really, I suppose, but with large chains of charity shops, they'll know where to give them. Perhaps they'll give them to poor areas of the country where they don't have Blu-ray players, like, I don't know, Yorkshire or something.
Funnily enough, I've been trying to find, for about nearly 10 years now, I've lost my copy of Alan Moore's From Hell graphic novel, which is a great big tome. Yeah. And I've been wanting to reread it a lot recently. And I know a couple of my friends have got copies, and I was around one of their houses the other day, and I said, is it all right, can I borrow one of your books? And he said, yeah, sure. And he's got these shelves in the front room. I went, oh, can I borrow From Hell? Because I'd really like to reread that. He went, can you borrow what? I said, From Hell. He said, I haven't got that. I said, yes, you have. It's been sat on that shelf for about the last 10 years. He went, oh, that's weird. I've never brought it.
Oh, no. So,
oh. It turns out it was my copy.
Oh, you're joking.
Oh, really?
That I lent him 10 years ago. Yeah. So there we are.
Anyway. We're here to review the last two broadcast episodes of Season 12 of Doctor Who, Fugitive of the Jadoon and Praxis. Fugitive of the Jadoon, written by Vinay Patel and with a co-writing credit for Chris Chibnall, directed by Nida Manzoor, who I think directed...
She directed Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror.
Nikola Tesla, didn't she? That's right, yes. Anyone want to start us off?
Do you want to? Why don't you start for once, Doc?
Yeah.
Because I started off the very last one. I started off Nikola Tesla. Well, it starts off as a bit of a runaround. And you almost expect that from the title, don't you? Anything with the Jadoon in isn't going to be canon changing, is it? You expect. Particularly nothing as ungrammatical as Fugitive of the Jadoon.
No.
And in fact, if you look at that opening scene, apart from looking at the piece of toast and saying, proper, which maybe wants her to die there and then, where Ruth is, you know, she's strolling blithely through the happy, sunny streets of Gloucester, gaily greeting everyone she meets with a cheery wave, bending down to stroke dogs and smile at everyone. I think it was John Aitken on the Proctor Who podcast who said it looked a bit like a tampon commercial. Which he didn't even think about it. Anyway, in the immortal words of Claire Rayner, let's press on. I quite liked Alan, the paranoid barista, and I liked how he's clearly infatuated with Ruth, but unusually for New Who, she doesn't see that as a reason to put him down sneeringly. Rose would probably have said, oi, what's your game, mate? Donna would have said, "Oh, not blooming likely, mister." Bill would probably have been nice, but she would have been more concerned with telling him that she wasn't into men before he'd even got out good morning. The bits of pieces I was really liking. I like the Jadoon ship, bit spiky, but a novel design. Interesting to hear the Doctor's been dumping her companions in order to travel home to Gallifrey every now and then.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the refreshing things of the episode, wasn't it? That the Doctor actually, it's broadened the palette that they've been colouring her with, so to speak. It was darker shades, wasn't it?
Yes.
And to see that she's, despite her obvious affection and love for her fam, it was nice to see the alien side of the Doctor suddenly coming back through. We haven't really had that from Jodie before, have we? She's been very, she's just very jolly and amiable generally, isn't she?
I think what works well here, and it works well in Praxeus next week as well, is we start off with lots and lots of things happening, and we've no idea why. Lots of little mysteries cropping up, and instead of solving them, they just move straight on to another mystery and leave us wondering, so who's Rose? Who's Lee? What's in that dossier of Alan's? Who's the fugitive? Is it Rose? Is it Lee? Who's hiring the Jadoon?
I mean Ruth.
It's Ruth, sorry, I'm going to keep saying that, aren't they? You can't help being carried along on the wave of it. And it helps enormously that the Doctor stopped glottal-stopping for some reason. I quite like the Jadoon in this. There's more of an idea if there was a dangerous force than just as comic relief.
Mm.
They won't even take any nonsense from the Doctor. I love the whole hackling over time thing.
Yes.
Give me 10 Earth minutes and we can have this resolved for you.
5 minutes.
9.
4.
Fine, I'll take 5. Hate it when they do that.
And actually, that must have been the first time for as long as I can remember that I actually laughed out loud watching something on Doctor Who. I just found that quite funny. What is the obsession with annoying old biddies recently? As if Vilma wasn't bad enough 2 weeks ago. Now we have Martha the Knitter. How dare you! So glad she died within seconds. Even Alan, the paranoid barista, deserved his short death with his stupid reaction to the Jadoon. Some enormous rhino monsters walk into your coffee shop, loaded for bear, and they sweep something off your counter. You don't try and beat them up, do you?
No.
Anyone want to take over from me briefly?
I didn't like Alan at all. It, not so much the actor, but his dialogue. All that all ears Alan stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, his dialogue was atrocious.
Yeah, I can't be certain, but, you know, I detected the touch of Mr. Chibnall with some of that dialogue, I think. But I have to say, apart from Alan and his dialogue, I thought everything else and every other character in this was great. All my notes for this episode just all say, oh, that's great, that's great, that's great. I had the joy of watching this the second time round with the Kellys.
Aha!
So I watched the first time with me and my flatmate, thoroughly enjoyed it. The second time round, I was sort of rubbing my hands, going, oh, I can't wait to watch this with them, see what they make of it.
Was it the first time for them?
Yeah, it was the first time they sat down to watch it, and I hadn't given them any spoilers, and because they're not particularly connected to Doctor Who's social media or anything, they hadn't picked any up.
Oh, I think there's a chance they might grow up sane.
Yeah, yes, I think they're just going to lead normal, healthy lives. I did speak to Eve. She's the older one. She's the... Oh, how old is she now? 8, I think. And I did ask her if anybody at school had been talking about Doctor Who, and she went, no. I was like, oh, okay. So it's not something that comes up in the school, because I'm pretty sure when I was a kid that somebody would have mentioned that if it happened when Doctor Who was at its peak in the Tom Baker
era. Oh, yes. I mean, I've told you how when I was 11, 12, 13, we were all in our classroom at school waiting to be bells to go to assembly. And this lad walks in, stands in the doorway and says, Darth Vader's Luke Skywalker's dad.
Yeah.
To show off that he'd got to see it before the rest of us had. If you're listening, David, I'm just not forgiving you for it.
That's slightly confusing, though, to me, is the fact that no kids were talking about it. Because this...
They actually had films in my youth, you mean?
Yeah, and they were talkies as well.
What do you mean, then, or last week, you mean?
Last week?
Yeah.
You'd have thought that'd be school playground chat.
Yeah, that's what I wondered, but apparently not.
Oh dear.
So how did they react?
Oh, well, they absolutely adored both the 8-year-old and the 4-year-old. Absolutely loved the Jadoon. As soon as the Jadoon came on, they were like, oh! And when they took their helmets off and they were space rhinos, oh, they absolutely loved it. And they particularly enjoyed the little one repeated verbatim Ryan's threat to the Jadoon leader to, what did he say?
Hey, you're not using that thing here, pal, so consider your rhino backside imperially regulated. Sounded tougher in my head.
Yes, she repeated word for word what Ryan said to the Jadoon leader. And then she looked over at her mum and said, backside means bottom, doesn't it, mummy?
Yeah, do you know, when Ryan says that and then pauses and says, oh, it sounded tougher in my head, it completely flattened that.
Yeah.
If he turned to Yaz and said, that means bottom, doesn't it? I don't love that scene.
Yeah, they absolutely adored that. At the end of the episode, I did say to Eve, did you understand that episode? And she looked at me and went, yeah, of course. And then she said, but don't ask me to explain it to you.
I suppose, if you think about it, they're ideal for children that age, aren't they, Jujun? Because whatever we may think of them, they're sufficiently violent and rough to be scary.
Mm.
But they're sufficiently, should we say, almost like comic in appearance.
Or Disney-esque.
Yes, to take some of that away.
Almost like they're from Robin Hood.
Yes, oh yes, exactly. Where they're all stomping through the woods in medieval gear. In fact, even I, you know, the Jadoon are going around actually killing people for resisting them. I find it hard to think of them as baddies. That may be the fascist in me.
I kind of feel in a similar thing about the Ogrons as well.
Yes, yes.
They are a mercenary race. That's what they do. Guns for hire.
That's why you have such a soft spot for Gruntly the Ogron, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's not many things that a young Ogron or Space Rhino can grow up to be, really. The career choices are pretty limited, aren't they?
Did you manage to stay unspoiled for Jack?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I have to say, well done to absolutely everyone. That includes the people who knew, like obviously people who reviewed it or seen previews, people who made the show, the people behind promoting the show and stuff, for keeping all of this under wraps and for not spoiling our surprises and, you know, like the thing with John Sim in World Enough and Time and letting us have these unspoiled shocks and twists, because it feels like a genuine delight and privilege to be watching it on broadcast and having no idea at all that these sort of things are going to happen.
Were you unspoiled for Jack Hayden?
Yes, I was, completely.
So thank you to everyone except the person who spoiled it for me on Twitter.
Oh,
for goodness sakes.
Who kept saying that he knew, but he wouldn't tell anyone. Then someone said, oh, is it that Jack's coming back? He said, oh, yeah, that's it.
Oh, for what? What's the point in that?
As I saw the morning of this, I thought I was so annoyed.
I've spoken about this before.
Those who speak don't know, and those who know don't speak. It's great to be in the know. It's great to have the scoop, to have the skinny. To be able to go to a reporter and say, I know something you don't know. And so the press becomes your constituents and you sell out the team. I'm not going to have a witch hunt. I'm not going to huff and puff. I'm not going to take anyone's head off. I'm simply going to say this.
I can kill you with my brain.
I can't say I was that really fussed. If he'd spoiled the Ruth Jo Martin thing, I'd be furious. But the Jack thing, because I'm not the sort of person who's thought, oh, I'd really like Jack to come back. I wouldn't have been that fussed, really. So how did you feel when you, because they start, not by showing, but they start with just his voice as a voiceover, don't they? Did you start thinking, hang on, is that?
Yeah, I didn't recognise him.
I thought it sounded like him straight away, actually, and was like, that isn't Captain Jack, is it? And yeah, I was thrilled. Not so much because I'm a Captain Jack fan, but because just I wasn't expecting it.
But maybe a larger-than-life character is like him is something that we need. Albeit only briefly.
But do you know what it made me realise was that I really actually quite enjoyed Captain Jack back in the day. And it was just good to have him. It was good to have that connection back. Again, I mean, I've said it before on this show, but Series 11, I did think to myself, yeah, I think we need to sort of strip everything back now. I'm kind of getting a bit fed up with all the folklore.
Yeah.
But actually, I think Doctor Who's been running for so long that you can't do without it now. You know, you have to have some elements of it because that universe is just too big. So to have Jack back, it was a huge teaser for him not to meet the new Doctor. To effectively come in, be a bit of lighthearted relief, but also set up what looks and sounds like is going to be the finale.
Yeah, his scene with Graham turning up and Jack going over and kissing him and giving him a massive hug and stuff. Telling him how sexy his hair was.
Just... Silver Fox here. That's so funny. I thought he was great in Doctor Who in previous years. I wasn't that keen on him in Torchwood. So I think as a supporting character, he's great. As a guy who's supporting the show, his own show, I wasn't that keen on him in Torchwood.
Having rewatched Series 1 fairly recently, or relatively recently anyway, I have to say that I really enjoyed his Captain Jack in that, and it made me realise how much I enjoyed his character, actually.
I was wondering, was that actually John Barrowman's voice, or was it dubbed? Because I was a bit confused at one show. Should we just do a little test now? Tell you what, Hayden, I will play a couple of lines of Captain Jack speaking from Fugitive of the Jadoon. And then if you'll do your world-famous impersonation of John Barrowman's voice.
Okay.
So, like, here's the first few lines of Captain Jack.
Oh, they are coming for me always, the nanogenes. Oh, they are coming for me always, the nanogenes. Oh, they are coming for me always, the nanogenes.
Cue Hayden.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? What's on the other side?
Oh, so I was wrong. This is John Barrowman to the life. And I loved how his reaction to finding out the Doctor was a she. Not some smart remark or joke, just, oh, this I've got to see. So would that have been the girl's first exposure to Captain Jack?
No, because I watched Series 1 with them.
Oh, of course, yes. So did they recognise him?
Yes, they did. Yeah, they did. I had to say, do you remember the gas mask children? And then they were like, oh, yes, of course, him.
And then going back to the rhino backside thing, excellent bottom.
Well, you just segued into the Jadoon. The animatronic head was really impressive.
Yeah.
On that. That was incredible.
Was it in the coffee house where... someone says to the Jadoon captain, you're after a fugitive, aren't you? And he nods. I thought that looked really good.
It really did.
Oh, it's brilliant. Is that Millennium FX?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, apparently they've seized their association with Doctor Who now.
No, have they?
Again, this is something I think I saw on social media. I can't remember exactly. It might be worth Googling.
Were they part of the clear out after, what's it called again? Millennium FX.
Millennium FX, previously known as Millennium Effects, is a production company which provided the prosthetics for Doctor Who, Torchwood, Sojourn Adventures and Class. Dum, 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 dum. After working on Doctor Who for a grand total of 15 years, Praxeus was the final contribution from prosthetics and creature design team, Millennium Effects. FX, going right back to, I better admit, this is, I'm reading off Doctor Who Online, going right back to Christopher Eccleston's first episode, Rose. Find the ending with the Praxeus virus skin effect from last week's episode. It's unsure why the team are leaving, but director Neil Gorton confirms the name with news on his Instagram page. Quote, so 16 years ago, the first episode of Doctor Who I worked on was The Autons, an alien intelligence that inhabits plastic and brings it to life to kill people. This is my last episode, and it's one about a space virus that infects people through plastic and kills them. And that must be a genuine quote for him, because if that had been invented by the Doctor Who press office, it would have been...
I am delighted to be...
Yes, with the wonderful Doctor Who family. I look forward to seeing more exciting adventures of the Doctor and the TARDIS. Well, that's a pity, though. I wonder why that is. I mean, you don't know. It may be that they're cutting budgets, or it may maybe actually they think they can find someone better, couldn't it, I suppose?
Possibly.
What were we talking about? Oh, you were saying how great the Tudun look.
I thought they were fantastic in this.
Yeah, me
I
too.
I really did. And they were quite menacing as well. They weren't silly, like I suppose they have been portrayed as in the past.
Yes, yeah.
They didn't suffer from Suntaran syndrome, did they?
No.
To be honest, up until that point, up until the point where Captain Jack came back, I was just enjoying this as a really sort of kind of smooth, almost Russell T. Davis-like kind of episode.
Yes.
It just felt like it was flowing along beautifully with nice characters and interesting villains in the Jadoon. And I would have been quite happy if the whole episode had just cruised along in that gear. Towards the end, I think I'd have been more than satisfied. And for it to have developed into what it did was most unexpected.
Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't the Jadoon captain supposed to be called Paul Condon?
Yes.
Yeah, after Paul Condon.
A salute to Paul Condon.
Yeah. Mm.
Do you know Paul Hayden?
No, I never met him, unfortunately, face to face. But yeah, he seemed a very nice man.
So did we, I did the two of you arrive unspoiled for Ruth's revelation?
Oh, yeah.
I think the whole country did, didn't they, unless they were involved in it. So, we start off in her job as a tour guide, then she's collecting the cake, then the Jadoon arrive, then they're in her flat saying, I want to use a fugitive, then they're in the cathedral, and she's doing her little bits of martial arts stuff, and then they drive that very long, lazy and leisurely drive to the coast they make in the middle of the action.
Yeah.
Did any of you, during any of that, until the actual reveal, twig? Because, Mark, you were talking about the Gallifreyan writing around the fire alarm, weren't you?
No, I think Hayden mentioned that, didn't he?
Yes, I mentioned it. Yeah, yeah.
Mark, Hayden. I've mixed the two of you. You're both the same.
There's Gallifreyan writing around the fire alarm in the lighthouse, yeah.
But did you notice that at the time or in retrospect?
In retrospect, because I watched this straight after. After I spoke to you guys, anyway.
Yeah, in retrospect, also, the way she's looking at that watch at the beginning is obviously a slight clue, isn't it? And she's really concentrating on time. And then there's that hexagonal mirror on the wall.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was now. I sat there with my flatmate watching it. And I think it was during the drive, because the fire alarm flashes up briefly in an image in her head, doesn't it? As they're driving along. And I said to my housemate, I wonder if she's another Time Lord. I said she could be hiding. And then I was asking him if he remembered...
Family of Blood.
Yeah, Family of Blood. And he had no
Human
idea
nature,
what I was talking about. I said, there's this thing called the Chameleon Arts where they can sort of lock their real selves away in a fob watch. They basically become human. They forget who they were, and they basically live their lives as a human until they open the fob watch, and then their memories all come flooding back. And so I did mention that, but I had no idea that she's going to be the Doctor. I did think she might be a Time Lord. I didn't even think she was going to be... I know a lot of people were thinking at that point that she's the Rani. But,
yeah.
Which is, a fair enough thing, but I didn't even think that. I didn't think she was going to be a Time Lord that we already knew. I just thought the Doctor's found another Time Lord.
You know how naive I am about Secret Revelations, that I actually was spoiled for John Sim in World Enough and Time.
Aww. Oh, yes, some of you say.
And still, started watching it and completely forgot that I'd been spoiled about it and didn't realise that it was him. You know, and he's always playing the alien and all the prosthetics.
Yes.
Until the minute he reveals himself. Oh, right. So I was watching this as she breaks the glass in the fire alarm. And I was thinking, that's... You think they would have used a different sort of gold swirly effect? That looks a bit too much like the Chameleon Arch thing. That's just a twig.
Yeah, the other bit, at the same time that that's going on, the Doctor's outside digging up that grave.
Yes.
And that moment where she's uncovering it and she starts pulling the mud away and you start seeing the police box sign underneath it. It was just, honestly, absolute sent shivers down my spine. It's such a great scene. It reminded me of something that would appear in, like, the Doctor Who Monthly or something in the 80s.
Yes,
something like that. It's like one of the Stockbridge stories where the Fifth Doctor goes to a quarry somewhere and these people have blasted away a bit of the rock face and sort of uncovered ground that's tens of thousands of years old.
Oh, yes, yeah.
There's the imprint of the TARDIS in the rock. And it's like, what the hell is that doing there?
Mm.
And then the next time he goes and gets in his TARDIS, it's all muddy, like it's been off and done something else by itself. So I was having flashbacks to that.
Well, do you remember when I was joking a few weeks ago about people who deliberately film themselves during revelations?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Reaction videos.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure whether it's genuine. I literally gasped out loud when they revealed the TARDIS in the grave. I've never done that before.
Oh, it's brilliant.
And if we were prepared to release footage from the Hoosier internal security cameras, you'd see that, but I'm afraid there's too much that's on there that we can't reveal, unfortunately. What was your reaction to the TARDIS reveal, Hayden?
Oh, it was fantastic. I thought it was brilliantly shot, just brilliantly unveiled. It looked a bit too clean to have been there for a number of years, though. Like, when she took the mud off, you could tell they just padded that on there, hadn't they?
Well, it's the hats acting as a sort of Teflon coating, stopping from
sleeping. It was a fantastic moment. It really was. It could be one of those moments that could be quite defining for the 13th Doctor's era, actually. One of those moments that really sticks out.
Oh, it's an incredibly iconic image, isn't it? The direction on that whole sequence.
Mm.
I mean, for this whole episode.
Mm.
Who was it who directed again?
Nida Mansour.
That's it, Nida Mansour. Her direction on this one, and I think I spoke a lot of times on the last podcast about how much I loved the look of Nikola Tesla.
Yeah.
Well, not the actor, I mean the story.
That's one way to start rumours.
Yeah, it's a very handsome man. Yeah, her directing's fabulous. Huge fan of it. Is she back again, do we know? Or is that her done for this series?
No, it just mentions her name. Doesn't say how often she's going to be in it. But yes, I thought that. I loved, as irrelevant a point as it was, you know, when the Doctor's climbing up the lighthouse steps up to the lamp room, and it just looked so much more exciting visually than a prop.
Yeah.
Or you know, if they'd flown off to the Canaries or something and found some jazzy new art gallery that's been built somewhere. It just looked amazing there. And although it was clearly a lighthouse, it could have been anywhere. Mm. Anything could have been happening around there. Oh, it just, it got me going.
I think the reveal of Ruth and who Ruth was as well is really game-changing for the show, because I know we spent ages, didn't we? That night, dear listeners, we actually had a phone call, like a conference call straight after the show.
We all gathered in the Hoosier atrium and excitedly.
Yes, we did. And we chatted for nearly an hour, I think, didn't we, about how brilliant it all was. And it really was. It really was.
I was watching it on BBC iPlayer about 5 minutes after it had started. So I was 5 minutes behind the others. And during the climactic points, the alerts on my phone were going off like a bloody bloody fire alarm. I said, what are you doing? We've never done that before, have we? In the immediate aftermath of an episode. In fact, we were going to do an entirely separate episode just reviewing this until other things happened.
Yeah, it is the first time ever that we've felt that as soon as the episode's gone, there was just that feeling that we needed to talk about it straight away. Had to talk to somebody about it straight away.
But the interesting thing about that is it's a very rare feeling these days, isn't it?
It is.
Yes, yeah.
It really is.
I went round to visit my friend Dan and his young son Elliot, a 10-year-old, had watched this episode. And whenever I go round there now, he always asks me questions about the most recent episode that he's viewed. I was hoping to record him for the podcast, but he got all shy and didn't want to do it. But, I mean, his basic question was... He said he had lots of questions for this, but really all he did was ask me one question. Who is that doctor? So I kind of strung together some half-baked ideas I'd been having.
Which you are well practiced.
Yeah, which is that initially I'd presumed that Ruth was an alternate universe doctor.
Yeah.
But then Chris Chibnall came out and categorically said she is not an alternative universe doctor. She is the Doctor. And I think he's just trying to obfuscate slightly.
Well, everything you know is a lie.
But I don't think she's... For me, I don't think a bunch of pre-Hartnell Doctors seems right.
Oh yeah, that's not right.
Because it doesn't explain the TARDIS.
Or the sonic screwdriver.
No, it
And we've already seen the Hartnell Doctor as a boy in the barn in Listen, haven't we?
Presumably. We don't know that for certain, do we?
Oh, I think it was fairly explicit.
Well, it certainly seemed it at the time, but I'm wondering now if they can wriggle out of that.
But given that the Doctor regenerates into an adult each time,
yeah,
presumably he or she was only a child at the very beginning.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so I think...
How old's Elliot?
10.
Oh, right. Proper age for Doctor Who, then.
Yeah, yeah. I think that Ruth is the Doctor in this universe, but I think that Jodie's ended up in the wrong universe.
Oh.
So, technically, Ruth isn't from an alternate universe. Jodie is. That doesn't mean that Jodie isn't the Doctor, as we've seen. She's the Doctor who's gone from William Hartnell up to Jodie Whittaker and all points in between.
Yeah, yeah.
But at some point, possibly when she fell to Earth, she was in an alternate universe for her.
So, the Ruth Joe Doctor...
Is the Doctor
who belongs in that other universe.
Is the one, yes.
Which Jodie has somehow slipped into.
Ryan, Yaz and Graham that we know are all from that alternate universe. That's where the Doctor's ended up.
I thought it was interesting that you don't often see that, do you? Within a very short time after the episode goes out, they release a press release denying a fan rumour.
Mm.
Now that's strange, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, because there's very strong rumours, isn't there, that only Graham is going to stay on as a companion. Now, I think if it turns out that our Doctor has to go back to her universe, I mean Jodie, the Jodie Doctor has to go back, then Ryan and Yaz probably wouldn't want to go with her. But there's quite a good possibility, because Grace died in the Ruth universe, that there's still a Grace in the Jodie universe. And perhaps in the Jodie universe, she might have lost Graham to cancer, possibly? I don't know.
Possibly, yeah.
You know, a bit like Ricky and his grandma. Or Mickey and his grandma staying in the Cyberman universe. As we know, there's no idea that's been used before that Chris Chibnall's not happy to pile into. So does that make sense? Do you get where I'm coming from?
I imagine that young Elliot is already in for psychiatric counselling. After hearing that explanation from you, Mark.
And maybe the Timeless Child is like the first Doctor, or like the very first, like the zero point. And maybe every time the Doctor, or even the Time Lord, travels in time, by travelling in time and changing that time when they get there, maybe they create a parallel universe every time they do that.
Hang on a second. Oh, I've just had a thought, though. So where does the Master fit into this theory? Because...
Well, he could be the alternate... He could be the alternate universe Master. He could be the Ruth universe Master.
He isn't.
Or he could be a different universe Master. I mean, we don't know how many of these universes there are.
That is true, but he must be from the Jodie Doctor, or from the 13th Doctor's universe, because they mention... The Pharos Project, don't they, in Spyfall?
Well, they don't mention it's the Pharos Project, though, do they?
Oh, that's true, yeah. Forgotten why they called it now.
Jodrell Bank.
That's it, Jodrell Bank, yeah. Ah, interesting.
This whole idea about, oh, is she a pre-Hartnell Doctor? Is she a Series 6B Doctor between Troughton and Pertwee? You do have to consider what a showrunner could foist on the public. Not in the sense that hardcore fans would be outraged, but in the sense that would casual viewers be at all interested in a story about what actually happened between the second and third Doctor?
Mm.
Or before the first? I mean, would anyone be interested in that? Other than a really hardcore fan? If the really hardcore fans are going to be opposed to that sort of thing.
Mm.
But this is good because it's getting us talking again.
Mm,
and this is something which I feel has been sorely lacking from Doctor Who over the last few years.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing to get us talking last season, was there? I know they mentioned the Timeless Child, but, you know, they mentioned it very briefly in a kind of throwaway line in Ghost Monument, wasn't it? And then we never heard of it again. So, was it Ghost Monument?
Yes, there were those little bits of cloth on the ground were whispering to her about the past.
Yeah.
But we've still got to wonder what it is that the Master discovered that so horrified him.
Well, this is what I was saying, is I'm wondering if by travelling through time, every time that a Time Lord travels through time, that they're actually causing these parallel universes to split off, which is putting strain on the universe. So it's kind of like, almost like they're polluting.
Oh, don't you dare. So they'll not let it end with another lecture.
So it's like time pollution. They're polluting time. And that's what the Master's found out. And that's what's been hidden.
But my problem with that is, some people have suggested the Master's found out that the Time Lord did something horrifically criminal to some entity, maybe this time, this child, in order to win the power of regeneration from it. But you have to ask yourself, would someone like the Master be outraged at that? He's not exactly someone of great morality, is he? So I was thinking, well, maybe if what suppose it would really outrage him would be maybe if it turns out that there are regenerations before what they first thought were their first regeneration, and somehow the Time Lords have shut their memory off or something. I don't know at all. It's whatever it is, I just hope it's not disappointing.
I'm merely doing a little bit of amateur show running.
You haven't been the only one, Mark. Don't worry about that.
yeah, but at least mine stays in my head. Well, apart from the conversation we just had.
But the thing is, the martial arts stuff in the cathedral wasn't particularly doctorish, was it?
Well, you say that, Pertwee.
Hartnell.
And Hartnell, yeah.
The Hartnell liked a bit of fisticuffs, what is it, in the Romans and stuff, you know? He's,
and with he's the spade, handy,
bit tasty.
In the Reign of Terror.
And what about snapping off the Jadoon's horn? That seemed...
This is why I think that Ruth is the first incarnation of whatever line of doctors she is. Because she's very... You could take her temperament to be a little bit more like Hartnell's. She's a little bit... Before he gets that
twinkle in his eye. Give her a rock, she'd bash in a caveman's head with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, the way that she looks at the apparent death of Lee is...
Yeah.
You know, she seems fairly... She doesn't seem as empathic as later doctors.
No.
Or sympathetic.
And also, he seems like a soldier as well, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
He's clearly the Martha figure from Human Nature, isn't he? In that he is her protector.
Yeah.
Well, she's
hidden. But that Commander Gat recognised him. She completely fought alongside him.
Mm.
And was that a medal that was inside that metal box?
Yes.
And so I suspect that he's a Time Lord.
Yes, because when he's in the cafe, at one point when Alan reveals the cake to Lee...
Yeah.
Lee goes, oh, humans.
Oh, does he?
Yes, he does.
Just as the TARDIS is appearing. I didn't notice it on the first watch because my ears are listening to the TARDIS appearing.
What is the matter with you? Why didn't you let it go?
You want to take this outside?
Stop asking me that every time I come in here for a latte. Humans.
Through here.
What did we think of Joe's TARDIS interior?
Oh,
glorious.
That looked beautiful.
That was almost like the gasp I made at the revelation of the grave.
Oh, I adore it. The colours. I mean, it could do with being a little bit brighter, perhaps, but I suppose it is half asleep. It looks lovely, didn't it? I just thought, I mean, I can see why they don't have a TARDIS interior like that, because they like to have TARDIS people sat on the steps and the doctor at the console, and they like to have somebody sat over here and somebody sat by that column and somebody standing over here when she's got 19 people in there, you know, and you can do nice sort of things. Whereas there isn't a whole lot you can do with that console apart from have people just standing around it. But, oh, man, it just looks so nice.
That self-destruct rifle almost goes in with the snapping off the horn as well, doesn't it?
Yes, that's what I meant about her being quite ruthless.
And they've clearly, whatever they've been doing, the three of them, Commander Gat, Lee and Ruth, or Joe, have all been in a war together, haven't they?
Because they're clearly military trained, I would think. They seem to be, don't they?
I love the two doctors speaking simultaneously. That, I mean, I suspect that was done in post-production to make it rather than the actual acting.
Can I just go back to Lee for a minute? I thought he was great as well because I really didn't trust him. I didn't like him. At first, I was completely on Alan's side of things because I presumed, there is something wrong about this Lee bloke. Yeah, he is up to something. There's something wrong about him. And I was thinking, oh, yeah, what's he doing? I was thinking, oh, that lovely Ruth, and he's lied to her, and he's cheated, and he's really a bad un, and that nice Ruth's going to be betrayed by him. I thought, oh. Yes, yeah, so I thought it's a great performance by Neil Stook, isn't it, from Game On. Neil Stook is absolutely loving it on Twitter. I found his Twitter feed.
Yes, I saw that.
And
yeah.
Followed him. And he was interacting with anyone and everyone who was who tagged him in, which I thought was lovely. Fans were going nuts about the episode, and he's quite happily chatting away to them and teasing them terribly, so that when they were saying, I was so sad that we won't see your character again, and he's like, well, the BBC didn't say I died, with a winking emoji.
Is it Neil Stook, as in S-T-U-K-E? Stook.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know him. I don't recognise him.
No, well, you Game On's probably early 90s, mid-90s.
Okay.
So, yeah, you'd have only been about six or something.
Hayden was in Haverhill Library trying to reach the Doctor Who novelisations on the third shelf.
Yes, it was.
What do we think of Jack's warning?
An empire of evil. In ruins, right now. Brought down to nothing, finally. But that could all change if she doesn't listen to this message. To defeat them, the Alliance sent this thing back through time, across space. Tell the Doctor, the Lone Cyberman, don't give it what it wants. At all costs, tell her.
I mean, do we think this is entirely separate from the whole Timeless Child thing, or...?
I don't know. They've revealed a... spoilers, but they revealed the titles of the last two episodes today, haven't they?
Oh, yes, they have.
Oh, have they? What are they?
Do you want to know what they are?
Yeah, please.
Okay, episode 9 is Ascension of the Cybermen, which is in no way like The Rise of the Cybermen. It's completely different. And the final one, episode 10, is The Timeless Child. So whether or not they're going to be a two-parter or not, I don't know. I mean, it'll certainly be a new idea if we have a Cyberman two-parter as the finale to a season, won't it?
Mm.
Quite sure about Ascension. I mean, strictly it's Ascent, isn't it? Although Ascension means the same thing, it's more in the sense of Christ ascending to heaven that it's used.
Yeah.
Well, that's maybe the point.
I've seen a fair bit of praise for The Amazing Thing is Joe acted so much better than Jodie. I can't say I noticed. Well, I think she put in a good performance, but I can't remember thinking, oh, that was an amazing performance. I do wonder whether it's people jumping at the chance to diss Jodie without being accused of misogyny.
Yeah, and I also think that because I've been critical of some of an aspect of Jodie's performance, which is that, which you've mentioned before, Doc, which is the chopping wood hands.
Yes, yeah.
And when she's doing her explaining, and I've found that started to really niggle at me when I'm watching it. And so, you know, Ruth obviously didn't have any annoying little habits like that.
Mm.
But neither did Jodie in this episode. I thought Jodie Whittaker was superb in this episode. Her performance, especially towards the end when Ruth is returning her on the TARDIS and the Doctor's just, you can see her just looking absolutely bewildered and her mind's turning over. And you can see all the cogs whirring. And I just thought that was a lovely performance.
I don't want this to sound as if I'm being carping, but I actually think some of her best... And it actually, on reflection, just sounded an awful thing to say. But I don't mean it to. I think some of Jodie's best bits... actually, when she's not talking, she's just being silent.
Yes.
And staring at Gallifrey or reacting to Joe's revelation that she's a doctor.
Yeah. Yeah, but that shows good acting skills, doesn't it? Because
yeah.
She's doing far more. You know, she's doing a lot of heavy lifting with just expressions.
Yeah. This is rare. I think Mark and I have been talking Hayden out of the...
Yeah, sorry.
Say something, Hayden.
No, I'm not sure what else I can say, really. I think it was an absolute triumph of an episode. And I think it was one that was actually, I say sorely needed. I think this series actually has been rather good so far. But I think it got people talking about Doctor Who again in a way that maybe it hasn't been spoken about actually since Jodie started.
No, I think the return of the Master gave the start of the series a real shot in the arm.
Yeah.
That it definitely needed. And then this was just an unexpected surprise present that turned up from nowhere in the middle of the season.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And it's like we've unwrapped it and gone, oh, thank you, I can't believe what you've got us. That's exactly what we wanted. And that's how I feel about this episode.
I can't agree with Eve on Ryan's line. One, it sounded tougher in my head, just sounds...
Oh, it wasn't Eve, it was the little four-year-old who liked that line.
Who's that?
Caitlin.
Oh, sorry. But that's also, consider your rhino backside regulated. Where does Ryan get off throwing racist insults at aliens? He's not a rhino. He just looks like one.
Yeah.
Well, all that complicated theorising was, of course, just a lot of fan Jodrell Bank. Sorry, fan Pharos Project. Have you got anything more to say about Fugitive?
Yeah, I don't think so.
No. We've given it a lot of love.
But marks out of 10?
Big happy 9.
Snap. I think it's going to be a 9 out of 10. Actually, no, I'm going to go 9.5 out of 10.
I'm going to give it a 9.5.
Woohoo!
I don't think anything with that Ryan and Yas in can quite make a full 10. But I also think that if I always keep saying, oh, I'll save a 10 for if anything better comes along, then I'll never give one. I'm going to give it a 9.5.
I think I gave a 10 to World Enough and Time and or Doctor Fors, didn't I?
Oh, that's understandable. Interestingly, in fact, something just occurred to me. I'm constantly criticising Ryan and Yaz, I know I am, but it's only recently occurred to me. I don't actually dislike either of them. I mean, I used to loathe Amy and Clara with the Heat of 1,000 Suns because I just found them supremely irritating. But then I think it's because I found their characters irritating. I think my problem with Ryan and Yaz is that I just wish, can we have some characterisation, please? You know, something for us to get hold of. I think the problem is that there's nothing much there. Whereas with Amy and Clara, there's a lot there, and it was annoying me. Right, so that's our review of Fugitive. Before we start going to the next one, because Hayden's been away, I realised that we never got around to our competition for finding a better rhyme for our official Diddly Dum song, where we decided that Diddly Dum E Bar Gum was a bit trite. So I think one of us suggested Diddly Dum Tribe of Gum, didn't we?
That was me.
Someone suggested something brilliant, I think, on social media after that, and I completely forgot what it was. So if anyone can remembers what their suggestion was, please let us know, because I could do with knowing. We have had a suggestion in, we've had a letter from a Mr. O.B.W. Kenobi of Tatooine, who suggests Diddly Dum Wretched Hive of Scum.
Doctor Who podcasters, you've... <Was he?
laughs> Oh, my God!
You frightened them off, but don't worry, they'll be back, and in greater numbers.
And in greater numbers.
Mark can do Obi-Wan! Yeah. Certainly tells us that Mark will be talking to us about not dumping bodies in the river at the end of this podcast. The following Sunday we had Praxeus, writer Pete McTighe, who wrote...
Kablam!
And with a co-writing credit for Chris Chibnall. Director Jamie Magnus Stone, who I have to confess doesn't ring a bell. Let's have a look. He directed two filming blocks consisting of 4 episodes, including Skyfall Part 1. Yes, he directed Skyfall Part 1, Praxeus, and he will direct Episode 9 and 10. I've got more to say about this, I'm not going to start with this one.
Oh, happy to let Hayden. Did you want to go first?
Yes, Hayden's been struggling to get in. That bloody Mark! You can never get a word in edgeways with him.
I know. Do you know what? Ever since he's been on this show, you know what? Not only has my fee gone down, but my screen time has gone down.
Who's that?
I don't know. Generic old fart complaining. I've been in this business 30 years, and I've never once in my life. I love the fact that whenever I do like a snide voice or anything now, it's a character or a terrible impression of somebody. I must admit, I wasn't completely on board with this one. I think there was a bit of a link to the previous episode, wasn't there, that they sort of brought it up and it was going to be talking about this sort of virus, this bacterium in 3 different parts of the globe. I think it tried to be quite epic in scope. I quite enjoyed it. I tried to look over its foibles, and then I realised, oh no, I can't do that because I'm reviewing it for the podcast. It wasn't as strong as the rest of the series, but I think it was better than Orphan 55. But there were some glaring problems, I thought, with... I'm not sure whether it's the script or whether it's the way it's been...
Edited,
yeah. I think it might be the way it's been edited. But first of all, I'll get the criticisms out of my head. So, once again, this is a Chris Chibnall... Chris Chibnall story, where it talks about three things, different places in the world, which is very much resolution territory, which is slightly unoriginal.
And Spyfall. It's the next episode as well. The next episode is set in three different places.
Oh my God. Okay.
And, hold on. Andy wrote Power of Three, so I think he's got an issue.
He does things in threes. Yeah. And his favourite bands are those with only three band members, like Muse. There you are.
Or Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Bachman Turner Overdrive. Or Cream.
How many people in that, sorry. Probably edit that bit out.
And Cream as well, of course.
Mm.
Yeah, so I quite liked it, but I didn't like the fact that the whole of the story just seemed to stop during that moment when I think it was Jake was talking to Graham outside and the birds had weirdly stopped attacking, even though they were hammering that lab at that point. And then that, I've forgotten the name of the guy now, but the guy who gets attacked is sort of completely forgotten about.
Aramu.
Yeah, so when Aramu is attacked and killed, I know in that instant when you're running away from these birds that are all trying to murder you, you're not going to be thinking, oh, where is everyone? But then I kind of think the Doctor would, and I think the Doctor would have noticed he'd been gone for quite some time. So I don't know whether that was never included in the script or it's just glossed over and just like, no, he's dead, he's expendable, he's gone.
Oh, believe me, guys, if I was being pecked to death out in Biscuit Factory Square, I wouldn't be feeling sorry for myself. My last thoughts would be ones of anger towards you two saying, where the bloody hell are the pair of them? In fact, I might, my last breath and my fingernails, I might scratch into the cobblestones, Hayden and Mark, you deserted me in my hour of need.
And then just to piss you off in death, we'd add another S to deserted.
And you, as you sort of walk over my body, completely ignoring it, as you hand over a set of house keys to Brendan.
Good old Brenny. Yeah, and then when she saves Jake at the end by materialising the TARDIS around him a split second before it blows up, it did make me think she couldn't have thought much to Adric then, could she? But then I was reminded, and I think it was actually by Brendan on Twitter, that that the TARDIS console was damaged in Earthshock, which didn't allow him time to get out.
And although this sort of gets messed up by the whole Skyfall thing, to be fair, she saved him just before he died, didn't she?
Yeah.
That Hadrick had already died, and it would necessitate the Doctor going back to change time. Of course, we do that these days, don't we?
Why couldn't she do that at the end of Orphan 55 for Bella and Kane?
Oh, she didn't like them.
Well, yeah, clearly. I'm a romantic, but I don't much care for dysfunctional families.
There's nothing but dysfunctional families in Doctor Who these days. Right, so Hayden, you were talking about Aramu having been pecked to death and no one helping him.
Uh-huh.
Just after Jake and Graham had a little chat on the beach.
Yeah, which was odd. Said the birds to stop attacking them so that they could have that little tete-a-tete.
But it's like, talking of Peter Jones in just a minute, in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the 15-mile-high statue of Arthur Dent throwing the new traumatic cup. The giant marble one-mile cup stays in midair because it's artistically correct.
That's true. Yeah, fair enough.
It just occurred to me. Where did you fall from?
Let go!
First, tell me where you fell from.
A huge cold-white cave in the sky.
And what in the cup?
What do you mean, cup?
The cup? It's part of the statue.
What statue?
The statue.
I don't know what you're talking about. Let go.
You mean you haven't seen the statue?
No. Should I have done? good, is it? Let go! Your claws are digging in my back.
Only decent thing our ancestors ever did. Come on, I'll show you.
To go down, not up.
There. You see it?
What?
Look up, look up.
You're hurting my neck.
Zoom me over. Look. That's it.
But it looks like... just like a plastic cup hanging in the sky. It's about a mile long.
Looks like plastic. Carved from solid marble there.
But the weight of it. What's supporting it? What keeps it there?
Art.
Art?
It's only part of the main statue. 15 miles high. It's directly behind us, but I'll circle round in a moment.
15 miles high?
Very impressive from up here with the morning sun gleaming on it.
But what is it? What's worth a statue 15 miles high?
It was of great symbolic importance to our ancestors. It's called Arthur Dent throwing the Neutromatic Cup.
Sorry, what did you say? Look, the statue. How did you get the cup bit to stay where it is, unsupported?
It stays there because it's artistically right.
What?
The law of gravity isn't as indiscriminate as people often think. You learn things like that when you're a bird.
So the birds stop attacking them because that's what's artistically proper.
To be honest, at that point, I did feel that I was quite happy for somebody just to sit down for a couple of minutes and have a breather.
That is true. That is true. Yeah.
What, when they were, when Graham and Jake were chatting to each other?
Yes, yeah. I thought it was a much-needed point.
I think that's a lovely little scene, that, as well.
Because I think we've been hurtling pell-mell through the episode for quite some time. And it was just nice just to go, just relax for a few minutes and just have somebody having a little bit of a chit-chat, you know, a little bit of twinkly Graham.
But on the whole, I enjoyed it. And I thought it wasn't as on the nose with its subject matter as maybe Orphan 55 had been. And I think anyone who says, oh, I don't enjoy Doctor Who anymore because it's very preachy nowadays, I just think that's a load of rubbish. It's all about the conviction. It's all about how you realise that message.
Yeah. The thing is, the message is pretty sound. I don't think they're overtly political so much. A lot of people have been saying, oh, it's too much politics, but a lot of it's environmental stuff, isn't it? And looking after the planet seems to be the main theme.
In the 70s, we would have thought that was a good thing, wouldn't we? When they were doing Green Death.
Mm.
Panorama Chemicals, or whatever they were called, Global Chemicals.
Mm. You know, the thing is, the messages that they're supposedly preaching, you know, they're not bad messages to have in a kids' programme.
Can you imagine back in, what would it have been, 1973, when Green Death was on?
Mm.
That the equivalent of social media. We would have watched the end of Green Death. We would have gone up to our bedrooms, taken out our Basildon Bond letter writing set that our grandma gave us for our birthday, and started a letter to our pen pal in Costa Rica saying, Dear Gabriella, you can't believe how woke Doctor Who is becoming these days. Or you'd have a chat in the playground.
I suppose the problem is, I do think the end of Orphan 55, and the Doctor's done this a couple of times before, it does seem a little bit too much like she's almost turning to the camera and delivering a monologue.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem, whereas I think, to be fair, with the Green Death, it feels like it's more delivered in the middle of a conversation. It feels more of a natural beat for the Doctor to say. It feels more of a natural part of the conversation that's going on. Mm. And I think with Praxeus, because it's so much intertwined with the plot...
It's not to stop the action, deliver a lecture.
No, it's because it's there all the time. The plastic pollution thing is there all the time. It runs as a thread throughout the entire plot, so it doesn't feel like there's suddenly a...
Whereas with Orphan, the global warming thing isn't actually part of the plot, it's just a mention. It's backstory, isn't it?
Mm.
Oh, this is why this planet's like this, but it's not actually an immediate danger to us.
No.
The global warning, we might as well just land it on another planet that's full of monsters. I enjoyed it initially, as like Fugitive. I was swept along by it. I think there's no denying that the overseas filming is mightily impressive. I was thoroughly taken in by South Africa standing in for Madagascar and Peru. But they could have had South Africa standing in for Chipping Norton, I probably wouldn't have noticed. And like with Fugitive, we keep being presented with a little unanswered mystery. Who's he? Who sent him that text message? What's up with the birds? And visually it's a treat, and very visually inventive. I like the novel look of Death by Praxeus. You know, where they... into...
Oh, yeah, the people exploding is great.
And there's finally a serious attempt to give the companions something to do by separating them from the Doctor. And not just a few streets away, but world away. I liked how she, as they were resolving things, she just kept turning up in the background behind them.
Clearly, she'd
jumped into the TARDIS and come, but didn't need to show us that. I loved that little neat bit of pacing there. Graham continues to act most of the TARDIS team off the screen without really doing anything. I actually loved that little beautiful scene on the beach where he's chatting to Jake about marriage. It's one of those daisiest daisy conversations, or I can see my family whenever I like Victoria conversations, utterly irrelevant to the plot, and all the better for it, because it's all about character. Jake talks about how significant it is when you're married to someone that impressive.
Yeah.
And you see him talking on the other side of Graham, and you just see Graham's face in front of you slightly out of focus, and you know that he's thinking about Grace.
Mm-hmm.
And his face hardly moves at all. The corners of his mouth move inwards very, very slightly, but you get everything he's feeling about the memory of Grace. Not sure whether that's brilliance acting or just that they're giving him more of a character backstory than they're given to Yaz and Graham. A little like how many of Jodie's best moments are becoming when she says nothing and she's just reacting with her face. Not gurning, but just hardly doing anything with her face. Like when she steps out of the TARDIS and stares at ruins of Gallifrey.
Mm.
And she's not going, oh my God. Film this on your phone and put it on YouTube. And it's certainly an improvement on Series 11. That's not saying much. But what worries me is, and it's the bane of podcasting, I wonder how much rewatch value these stories have got. Because once you rewatch them, you start noticing the flaws very quickly.
Yeah, but over time, they will become endearing in the way that when we watch stuff like, Frontier in Space, you know, the Ogron monster at the end, it's more endearing now than crap, isn't it? That kind of thing. I don't know. Gruntly, let us know.
Ought it to matter how Adam sends a text message to Jake? Ought it to matter why Gabriella and Jamila chose to camp in the middle of a fly-blown rubbish dump? Ought it to matter who picked up Jamila's body and took her to a deserted hospital when the entire alien presence on Earth seems to consist of Suki and a handful of men in gas masks?
Oh man, you're just burning through my notes now.
Ought it to matter to us that Ryan, Yaz, Graham and even Jake suddenly appear to be casually au fait with alien tech? Mm. And yet, once the list does get that long, it does start to matter because it threatens your suspension of disbelief. And don't come up with this nonsense about, you're watching a show about an alien who can regenerate and who travels in a police box that's bigger on the inside, and you're worried about suspension of disbelief. Well, yes, but the show has made those things believable. There's nothing actually unbelievable about those things. What I find damaging is the casual neglect of credibility. Because once you're on a second watch, and all the little mysteries have already been answered, you don't have the saving grace of Russell T. Davies's era where the plot may be a bit ropey, but you can keep delighting in the characterisation. Or the other way around with Stephen Moffat. And even that's a bit exaggerated because it sounds like such a neat little antithetical couplet. Russell T. Davies is A but not B. Stephen Moffat is B but not A. You tend to forget that actually most of it isn't true. But I think with the Chris Chibnall era, a lot of the time, neither the plots nor the characterisations are solid enough to fall back on. I mean, why should we care about Jamila's death if Gabriella can't bring herself to?
Oh, can I just say that ending? I just thought that was ridiculous. She's with these two guys who've clearly got a lot of healing to do. They've got to work out their relationship. So they've decided to go on a second honeymoon. So she goes, I'll come along with you, right? Earlier on, she was sat in the TARDIS with Ryan, and she was saying, my friends died and stuff, and there's all this. This is all so much for me. And Ryan said to her, you'll get over it. And she turns to him and looks at him, sort of slightly scowling, and says, because you've known me for how many hours?
Yeah.
Is it like an optical illusion?
I really don't know. How long have you and Jamila known each other?
5 years. I don't know what I'm gonna do now.
You'll get through it.
OK.
because you know me for how many hours.
And then, literally hours later, she's standing there laughing and smiling on the beach, having her best friend, who she spent 5 years travelling around the globe with, has died, and also died horribly in front of her, because that would be an incredibly distressing thing to see. Even if that person's dead, if that's someone you care about and they're supposedly dead and their body suddenly starts reaching up and looking like it's alive and arching itself up and then calcifying and exploding, you'd just be absolutely... Instead, she's standing there laughing on a beach saying, yeah, I'm going to tag along with you on your honeymoon. We can vlog about it. It's like, Gabriella, what about your mate you've been travelling the world with? Gabriella's just like, well, she's dead to me, isn't she? She's dead to everyone now. So, you know, let's just go.
Yeah, but maybe she's in shock to such a point that she doesn't want to go back to reality and normality because of the...
Maybe tagging along with the boys is the only way she can think of getting back to Peru from Madagascar.
Yeah. The thing is, it's true that people grieve in different ways and it affects people in different ways.
Yeah.
And shock can affect people in different ways. But the point is, you kind of want to see it done in a way that still seems believable. Even if it's true that some people might have a bizarre reaction to death. Or they should explain it, or they should mention it. There should have been a line in there or something about the way that she's acting or something, rather than just having her look like a callous rotter. Who only cares about vlogging and hits.
Absolutely.
Sorry, rant over.
You feeling better now, Mark?
Yeah.
Gabriella, of course, being Doctor Who's first ever Portuguese-speaking facsimile of Chloe Webber. But it's not just her. The Doctor is at heart, I think, a deeply moral person. However casual he sometimes might be, where he doesn't seem to be grieving about Lawrence Scarman's death, he's a deeply moral person, and yet it's thought appropriate that her immediate reaction to the death by Praxis of the Submariner on the beach should be...
Okay, so with the understanding that was pretty alarming, don't be overly alarmed.
It never seemed to get into the show, but I always remember how in the Target novelisations, whenever one of the unit soldiers gets killed, we always got a few lines about how upset the Brigadier was, that he'd lost one of his men.
Mm.
And that was a big part of his character for me. Brigadier's job was to look after his men, and in the process try and help the Doctor.
The time monster, when he thinks that Captain Yates has brought it, and he's just shouting into his microphone, Mike!
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that just that one word says more about the character.
The Doctor's job is to look after all of us. You know, whoever kills one life kills the world entire. And they have her being flippant about someone having suffered what is a pretty horrific death. It takes something to make you feel sorry for Pip and Jane Baker. But to be lectured on getting Doctor Who right by someone who one day gives you this. I don't know, really. That's my rant over.
Well, it's confusing, isn't it? I'd say I think it's a superficially extremely exciting episode. And it looks fantastic. And the pace is breathless, isn't it? It just chop, 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 goes on and on. And it actually made it quite hard to follow. And I did wonder if that's by design, because it almost, you can't think too much. There's so much going on. And there's so much to think about on the first view, and for the casual viewer and for people who don't have to go back and reconsider it for a podcast, but there's so much going on that I think it kind of it stops the viewer from having to think, doesn't it? Also, I found that another thing that they seemed to do was they had a lot of very sort of technical scientific stuff said really quickly, with a lot of it packed in, and it was very difficult to follow. It's delivered far too fast and breathlessly. I think the Doctor's doing an explanation in the lab, and I think at one point Ryan suddenly stops her and says, what does that mean? And she just looks at him and says, Ryan, you just saved the world, or something.
Yeah.
She's just basically done a load of techno babble, and he's gone, what does that mean? And I was thinking, yes, do tell us. We don't get a reply. It frustrated me, that. I managed to watch this episode with another friend and his child. I watched this one with Elliot, the aforementioned 10-year-old, and his dad. And honestly, all the way through, they were both just questioning all the time.
Is Elliot now out of counselling?
You know, why is the hospital in lockdown? Why is it an empty hospital? Did everyone in there disintegrate? What? All those other points you made as well, Doc.
Oh, I think Elliot's a younger me.
Yeah, but Elliot as well was so...
Elliot could be my previous incarnation.
Yeah. He's the timeless child. but he's saying, why do they need that woman's lab? Because the TARDIS surely has far more advanced technology than is available anywhere on modern day Earth. Why would a lab on a beach be like, oh, let's get the astronaut out of here where I've got all my incredibly good scanning equipment and drag him into a lab where they've got a microscope?
Well, and what were your answers, Mark?
He also said when Gasmask Man went into the teleport and he was followed by Gabriella and Yaz, he said, well, that's stupid. I was like, well, no, it is, isn't it? He said, yeah. He said, because they don't know where they're going. It could be anyone on the other side of that. They've got absolutely no idea.
Yeah.
And then his dad said, my friend Dan, he said, the people who've come and gone via that teleport have got breathing apparatus on, which suggests that they aren't used to the Earth atmosphere. He said, so if you go through there, if you're in somewhere that's got a completely different breathing atmosphere to you, you're just going to die.
Yeah.
And not only that, but they've only seen one person use the teleport at a time. They don't know that going through with two people isn't going to leave them like some kind of weird brundle fly.
Really? What? Oh, yes.
Sorry, there's a fly reference where you have two people, a man and a fly, teleporting and they end up sort of mixing the DNA up and getting confused.
Oh, I saw a film about that once.
By the way, something disappointing. I think all up to now, they've been careful to use the Doctor Who word, transmat.
Yes.
Instead of teleport. And then these are, ah, it annoys me that. I sometimes wonder with your friend's children. But Elliot says to his dad, oh, Dad, it's Sunday. Can we watch Doctor Who? So, oh, we've got to wait for Mark to come round. Oh, well, can we watch it tonight? No, he's watching it with his housemate tonight. Oh, can we watch it tomorrow? No, he's watching with the Kellys tomorrow. Oh, can we watch it on Thursday? No, he's podcasting with the boys.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm starting to turn into Tom Baker turning up in random families' houses and watching it with the children.
What did we think of Adam and Jake? And I know we usually make a point of not commenting on what fans say, but this was so amusing as I had to repeat it. On Gallifrey Base, you know what they were complaining about? That the Adam and Jake's relationship was far too heteronormative. In other words, they weren't camp enough.
They were fine.
I thought he was really nice.
Can I say the funniest thing about that? I saw somebody on Twitter saying that they this was in a thread that do you follow Who Effects at all?
I may do.
On Twitter, I think they occasionally do a long sort of Twitter feed run about all the effects of each episode of a classic Doctor Who, or sometimes more recent ones as well. And somebody said, with no irony whatsoever, said, I didn't want two gay astronauts ramming themselves down my throat. To which Who Effects replied, I wouldn't mind any time.
I liked Adam and Jake, just because it looked like they weren't doing the, oh, let's do the stereotype. I've still not forgiven them for that stupid boy in Resolution. I loved Jake as a policeman. You know, when is it when Graham says there's some alien tech on the other side of this door? And Yaz turns his little detector and I know it's the other side. Oh, how should we? What should we do? What should we do? What should we do? Jake just kicks the door in and says, oh.
Whatever is giving off those weird readings is on the other side of that wall. He's on the other side of this door.
You're welcome. Lock from the inside.
Maybe if we went round the other way. Chat, 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 chat.
I like that very much. I thought the, what was that word you were mentioning at the beginning, Mark? The gyres were interesting.
Yes.
You know, they've got this the idea, it's a sort of swirling vortex, either, you know, a circular current of air or water. Mm. And they're saying, oh, that's how the tidal patterns form these big areas on the Earth's oceans where all the plastics collect. But it's also the sort of currents that form hurricanes. And Adam says, oh, when I was on the International Space Station, I was watching down from hurricanes. And I think it's also connected with, you know, all those sort of intricate flight patterns of all the birds going in there. I just wonder if there was some kind of, probably sounds far too complicated, really. But it was good. It was the first time I finally learned how to pronounce Jaya.
Oh, is it? Yes.
It's the first line of the Second Coming, isn't it? Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Oh, right, well. Da, 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 da.
Yeah, but I didn't know about the gyres. Well, I think I might have heard about them, but I thought that was interesting information. So I did actually learn something again from this episode.
I think I'm all out, really. I've not really got much more to say.
No, I've got more questions.
Go on. You have, or Elliot has.
No, another question that Ellie asked was, how did they avoid getting scratched? Why isn't everyone infected? And also, why does Praxeus work very quick sometimes or very slow? And sometimes it can affect you and then you'll suddenly, in seconds, you'll be exploding. And sometimes, like the other girl, Jamila, it can kill you, but then just leave you there until your friend turns up and then you explode. And also, it just seems like a really... I don't understand. If you're a scientifically advanced race and you've got this disease, you've got this bacteria on your planet, this sentient bacteria that's going around killing you, so you've got loads of people infected with it, what is the point of going to another planet to test cures on aliens?
Because, Mark,
that have different biology to you.
Because...
Oh, because. Oh, right.
Oh. I'm sorry. Yeah, I've been an idiot.
Shorter answers are always best, aren't they?
Yeah.
Shall we give it fun to watch, but not really that much.
Don't think about it.
Much to think about.
Yeah. And for that reason, I'm giving it a 7 out of 10.
I'm giving it a 6.5 out of 10.
Well, I'm going to be a bit meaner because I keep hearing people comparing this to Orphan 55 and saying this was either as bad as Orphan... Or, well, basically people say, well, that wasn't great, but at least it wasn't as bad as Orphan 55. Yeah. To be honest, I had more fun watching Orphan 55.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay.
And so because of that, I'm afraid I'm only going to give this a 5. Because it's... It's definitely presentation over content. It's just...
Yes.
I'm so irritated by the amount of holes in it that...
Style over substance, yeah.
Yes, thank you.
I've been watching... Every now and then the BBC puts a complete series of some old programme onto iPlayer for a few weeks. And I've been watching Last Tango in Halifax.
Right.
Which is a charming little... I don't know if you originally saw it. It's a charming little drama series. Admittedly led by big names like Derek Jacobi and Anne Reid. But effortlessly acted by the whole company. Teenagers to pensioners, and actually nearly all in fairly broad Yorkshire accents as well, which don't sound like comedy northern accents, and don't sound like a handy substitute for a personality. Now, I'll admit that the style of Doctor Who is somewhat removed from that. It's fantasy, it's adventure, it's not, you know, just talking to your family in the living room. But the difference in acting ability is almost shocking. Now, Brendan suggested on our last podcast that the direction may be at fault, that the actors weren't being told who their character is and what they're thinking behind the various stuff is. And it could be that, man, maybe Last Tango in Halifax was properly rehearsed. Mm. Just annoys me. Shall we wrap things up?
Yeah.
Right. Obi-Wan, have you got a message for us?
No, I'm not doing that. Like, terrible Obi-Wan.
I can try it if you want.
Yeah.
Obi-Wan, have you got a message for us?
Don't dump bodies into the river.
Obi-Wan, we have enemy ships in Sector 27.
That's no moon.
Try that again.
What? You mean, that's no moon?
Yeah, because you said moon in an Essex voice.
That's no moon. It's a space station.
Somehow something tells me that Obi-Wan won't be staying on the strength of the dumpster. And we'll finish off now, as promised, with a full round from My Era of Just a Minute in tribute to Nicholas Parsons. Bye-bye, everyone. See you next
time. Goodbye. See you till next time.
Be seeing you.
Brian, you begin the next round. The subject is limericks, and will you tell us something about the subject in just a minute, starting now?
I'm not very fond of limericks, possibly because I can't make them up. I find it very difficult to get the two middle lines, and the last line is always a bit too...
Peter Jones has challenged.
Repetition of line.
Yes, I
know. Line and lines.
I said line and lines.
That's right. You did two different words there. And we have to listen very carefully. So you have another point for a wrong challenge. 51 seconds on limericks, Brian, starting now.
Very often the end is very rude and something you couldn't mention here.
Kenneth Williams.
Two berries.
Yes, you said...
yes.
You said you would find it very difficult before. Very now, this was very... yes.
Right.
So, Kenneth has the subject of limericks, and there are 47 seconds starting now.
There was a young lady, a bride, who ate a green apple and died. The fruit fermented inside the lamented, made cider inside her inside.
Brian Johnston.
Inside her.
I do think you did repeat the word inside.
Inside.
37 seconds, Brian, with you, starting now.
Some lyric... Oh!
Derek.
Hesitation.
I know, isn't it rotten? It's so difficult playing
in my teeth.
35 seconds on limericks, Derek, starting
now. There was an old puff of cartoon who took a lesbian up to his room. They lay on the bed and suddenly said, who does what, with what, and to who?
Well, I mean.
Can I continue?
Lord Reith, turn in your grave. Brian Johnson challenged you, and we'd like to know what it was, Brian.
Well, there were two whats.
And I should think there were. In that situation, there were more than a few, but...
Right.
Derek, I think you've broken new ice in the realms of history of broadcasting, and if you want to write to us about them, please address your letters personally to Derek Nimmo, because you will get a personalised reply. with another limerick, perhaps. Brian, you have the subject of limericks, and there are 25 seconds left, starting now.
What I was trying to say before is that it's very difficult to finish some limericks, such as...
Derek Nimmo...
Repetition of difficult.
Derek, you got the subject back, and there are 21 seconds on limerick starting now.
There was a young lady from Colesville who set herself down on a mole's hill. The inquisitive mole stuck his nose up and said, what? May I retire? I think. Before I'm made forcibly redundant.
I think it illustrated Brian's point about difficult to finish a lyric.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think some of them shouldn't have been started, actually. But, Peter Jones, I'm pleased to say, got in on this round, because we might get one from him. So, Peter, yes, a correct challenge. I don't know what for, but it sounded correct. A shuddering halt, we're delighted to say. 12 seconds on limerick, starting now.
There was a young man of Torbay, when sailing to China one day, was lashed to the tiller by a sex-crazed gorilla, and the Far East is a very long way.
The voices of the podcasters cluttering up our atrium and denying any knowledge of us at the start of this episode were from the Doctor Who Show podcast, the Flight Through Entirety podcast, the Strangers in Space podcast, and the Nerdology UK podcast. And Master Tom Cockrum only happened to be Hig Hurtenflust.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dun podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydunpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydun, on Twitter at diddly_dun, or email us at diddlydunpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dun, the empty space that circles time!